Hey, this is Andrew, and I'm walking around the campus of Loyola University. And you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Good old days of college. You are listening to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's wonderful to be here with you today for show number 1021. And what we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. The great Bob Ferguson is our engineer on duty today in the WGN radio studio. And speaking of college, I was in college in the late 90s and early 2000s. And one of the memories I have is walking through campus and seeing some folks listening to like Rusted Root and standing in a circle and playing Hacky Sack. And Hacky Sack was never my thing, but it was a very chill vibe, as I guess you could say. People were pretty relaxed playing Hacky Sack. And my day job as a high school teacher, I noticed recently that there seems to be, and this is anecdotal, an uptick in kids playing Hacky Sack at school. And I'm thinking to myself, is this really happening? I mean, Hacky Sack kind of had its heyday in the 80s and 90s. And I never thought I'd say this, but I found an article from Good Housekeeping from this week that talks about the resurgence of Hacky Sack in the United States. And apparently, online, people are searching for Hacky Sack videos on TikTok. In the U.S., posts with hashtags containing Hacky Sack have increased over 330% in the last week. In the same time period, TikTok searches for Hacky Sack have seen an increase of more than 600%. I mean, hey, you know, it's keeping kids off of screens, so that's good if they're playing Hacky Sack. I don't know if they're listening to Rusted Root necessarily anymore, but hey, good for you, kids. But just make sure you're not doing it in the halls. That could get complicated. It's a delicate balance from what I've seen. I don't think I'd be that good at Hacky Sack, but who knows? It's back now, so maybe I should try. Speaking of education, we will explore on the show today how Chicago Public Schools used public money to take kids to a protest. We'll explore that controversy. Also, Cook County seems to be making it more difficult for those who are seeking to clear their names for wrongful convictions. We'll get the story. So, Hacky Sack on? Hacky Sack away? Yeah. On May Day, which was May 1st, many in Chicago participated in a May Day protest. Thousands of workers and activists marched to advocate for labor rights, immigrant rights, and social justice. Chicago Public Schools used taxpayer funds to send students to participate in the demonstrations. Nick Krichka is a historian, and he is an assistant professor of secondary education for social studies at the National College of Education at National Lewis University. He recently authored an opinion piece on what happened on May Day in the Washington Post, and he is here with us today on Outside the Loop. Nick, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mike. Great, happy to be here.
You got it, and I should also say you are a CPS parent, so you definitely have some skin in the game here. And I want to get your thoughts on this, because in this piece in the Washington Post, you said, and this is a quote, that what happened is a misuse, quote, misuse of labor history for an act of civic miseducation, end quote. So can you explain what you mean by this?
Sure thing. Yeah. And first, I'll also add, so in addition to being a CPS parent, I'm also a former CPS teacher. So I taught high school social studies for 10 years in the Chicago Public Schools before I decided to go back and become a historian. And now I train history teachers, social studies teachers at National Lewis University. But the point that I was making with that particular line is that labor history is essential. It's fundamental to any good history class. And the events of May 1886 in Chicago have a very prominent place in that history. It's a pivotal moment in the labor movement for the United States and locally. And what I was disappointed by was the fact that that occasion was being used to create a new definition of civic education, where students were taken not to learn about the conduct of politics, but to actually participate in specified political messages on May Day. So to my mind, this was really bad news for two reasons. One, it's really bad for the integrity of the public school system itself, because the public school system as a common good is supposed to have a nonpartisan character to it. It should be something that everyone who is served by the schools should be able to put their hands on that public good and basically believe that it is running things in a more or less neutral way. But it's also bad for political protest. It's bad for the model of political demonstration that we might want our students to understand as rooted in the legacy of those original May Day, 8-hour workday protests of 1886. And I can elaborate on either of those, Mike. I'll stop there.
Yeah, no. And again, as my listeners know, I'm a high school history teacher too. And this is something I think about. And one of the, you know, phrases that we sometimes say is, we're not here to teach you what to think, but how to think. And you even go into that in what you wrote for the Washington Post. And what I was struck by is when you take a look at some of the materials that CPS used in school, so part of a curriculum, I saw the Google slide presentation that was linked up through your piece in the Post. And, you know, they're asking questions like, where does Donald Trump violate kind of what was fought for as part of the Haymarket affair? And look, if a student gets to that conclusion that, hey, what's going on now is really a blatant violation of what people fought for, great, but it's not necessarily the job of the teacher to make them think that. And I was struck by how that activity specifically kind of pushes kids to that place.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I think, and I don't want people to mistake, you know, my critique or yours here for the idea that somehow students should be sheltered from issues of contemporary politics, or
right,
that controversial or complex political issues should be hidden from children. Quite the contrary. Social studies teachers actually play a very unique role in most schoolhouses, in that they are looked to as trusted guides for understanding the very complex and controversial political issues that swirl around us. And it's for that reason that social studies teachers have a very strong sense of professional obligation when it comes to restraining their own political impulses in front of their students. So one of the ways that you earn cred as a good social studies teacher, both with your colleagues and with your students and with the parents that you serve, is by not telegraphing some sort of clear political agenda or message in the way that you present very complex and controversial issues. And we actually, a few years back, I was the part of a research team that studied the state of U.S. history education nationwide. And we were studying that at a moment when there was actually quite a bit of political pressure from conservative activists against certain school district policies or ways of teaching American history. And what we found when we conducted that research, interviewing hundreds of teachers nationwide, is that teachers are actually quite good at responding to that type of political pressure with a kind of a courageous commitment to being politically inscrutable and balanced in the way that they teach. So teachers in the classroom understand this, that if you want any parents who might have a political axe to grind or a point of view on something to trust you, then you need to be somebody who is doing your due diligence in thoroughly researching the topic at hand and presenting a thorough and balanced account of those topics. So I think most school teachers understand this just kind of as a matter of almost sacred obligation. And so it's really disappointing to see a school system effectively endorse the opposite view.
And I think you mentioned this a little earlier, Nick, but what is, I think, distressing is, you know, as an educator, I want to support other teachers, but when something like this happens, I think it's very easy for folks in the mainstream to say, oh, there we go. You know, these liberal teachers, liberal education, indoctrinating these kids, when there are so many just dedicated teachers that they're very much not doing that. And they want to teach kids how to think critically. But this, when something like this happens, it's really easy to co-opt it and say, well, now this applies to all teachers.
Yeah, totally. That's a big risk I find, is that there are absolutely hysterical versions of this critique of, you know, biased teaching or whatever you want to call it, and it's not served. You know, teachers, in order to retort to that accusation, need to be able to point to the way that they do teach, which is to say, with integrity, with accountability to the historical record, and with a sense of political balance with regard to these more controversial questions. But if you have a school system using the occasion of a, you know, an important historical event like the May Day traditions to basically promote a particular political stripe, that makes it very difficult for the teachers to mount that type of defense that they need when somebody is accusing them later on of doing something that they're not doing.
Something you bring up here in this piece that you wrote in the Washington Post, and of course, I'll link up to it through the Outside the Loop channels, but only one of the Chicago Board of Education's 21 members publicly acknowledged the problems with this kind of state-sponsored political speech, as you call it. So people have been talking about it, but the response from the Board of Education hasn't been, I guess, substantial, could we say?
I think that's right. Unfortunately, I was very, you know, unpleasantly surprised when, you know, I presented the problem that, you know, you and I are diagnosing here in front of the Board of Education. And only one of the board members saw that this was clearly a line that should not have been crossed. And I'll add a little bit of a, you know, historical context here. To my knowledge, and I've checked with other historians on this question, this is the first time in any American city that a school system has used public funds to facilitate the transport of students to political protests. And that is not a precedent that the Chicago Public Schools wants to be known for. So, you know, there, like I said, there is one school board member who was ready to, you know, to bring this question to a vote such that the board members could be put on the record, because this agreement that was, you know, ultimately resulted in the policy was actually never even voted on by the board. It was devised by way of a memorandum of understanding between the teachers union and the school CEO. You know, to your point about the school board members, I think there is, unfortunately, I think it's a well-meaning tendency on the part of many of the school board members to see themselves as kind of amplifiers of unsung struggles or of, you know, marginal voices and so on. I think there's some value to having people go into public service for that reason. But now that they sit in actually very powerful roles as trustees of a public bureaucracy that has, you know, coercive power to compel attendance and all the rest, you have to actually change your perspective on some of those political questions, because all you have to do is imagine that somebody who didn't agree with you made the same decision and decided to use public funds to facilitate the transport of students to a political protest whose content you disagree with. So you can think, you know, if these are mostly political progressives on the Chicago Board of Education, all they need to imagine is a gun rights protest or a right to life protest or a pro-Trump rally. None of those would be appropriate for the school system to involve itself in funding as a matter of chaperones or of transportation. But in Chicago, it's very hard, I think, for some of these public servants to imagine being on the other foot, so to speak.
I think that's an interesting way of thinking about it, kind of flipping the script, as it were. And Nick, you recommend in this piece that parents should push Chicago schools to adopt a policy of institutional neutrality. Can you tell us what that means, this concept of institutional neutrality?
Sure. It's a concept that's quite old. It goes back to a lot of debates among university professors about the role of the institution and the academic freedom of the people who work within it. But many universities who have adopted some version of institutional neutrality have basically decided that, well, if we want a truly free environment for diverse speech within our institution, that means the institution itself needs to not speak on some of those questions. And public schools are a little bit different insofar as the teachers within the school system aren't, engaged in the type of, critical inquiry or maybe politicized opinion making that university professors might be up to. But in a way, it's even more important for a public school system to adopt a policy of institutional neutrality because of its status as a publicly managed institution. So since everybody in the Chicago school districts is party to this this public trust, the institution should ideally recuse itself, restrain itself from making any sort of big gestures politically. And again, just to reinforce the point I made a moment ago, there are examples in some red states today where there are school superintendents and school boards attempting to paint MAGA stripes on their local school institutions and mandate more politicized or ideological or religious curriculum. And there's no way to object to that unless you have a vision of an institution as having an obligation to remain neutral.
Nick, you also talk about this in the piece, that doing something like what Chicago Public Schools did and having students using taxpayer money to send students to participate in these May Day demonstrations, it's just not good for protesting. I mean, that's not really, in the traditional definition of protesting, and you put this in the article, protesting doesn't require a permission slip.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's a, as we said, in any good civics class, any good history class, you're going to study these important moments where mass movements actually exerted leverage and affected historical change, whether it was in the labor movement or during the civil rights movement. But what was important about those moments is that the people who organized to create protest did so in opposition to a power structure. If the protest that you are trying to show to kids is something that is officially sanctioned by the school board, supported by the mayor, and goes along with paid days off for chaperones and permission slips from parents, then that is not really political protest. There's nothing political about it in that sense. So that, again, I think is not a good lesson for students to learn about what political action could look like.
You know, I'm just thinking about all of this, kind of putting it all together. And you said before that labor history is really important, and it is. I mean, I teach it in my classroom. It's part of our story and really has given rise to a lot of important events and progress as we progress here throughout our time here on this rock. And, you know, where we're all headed is, it seems like, especially today, and this has been kind of fomenting over the last few years, that there is such this us versus them mentality, and it's becoming harder for us to kind of come together, see where we disagree, hash that out in a civil and respectful way. And you could blame a lot. You know, I think the easy thing to say is, well, social media, and I'm sure that's certainly a part of it, and where we're going with technology and information and access to it. But something like this, when we think about education can be a place where diversity of thought should be encouraged, and we should learn how to listen to one another. And it's fine to disagree. You don't have to agree with everybody, but how do we figure this out in a civil way? And I feel like what's happening here when a school district does what happened on May Day, or as you were saying, in maybe some conservative parts of the country, it's just contributing to this divide. So as you look forward here, do you see this maybe if we keep going down this pathway, do you think this is going to lead to a bigger kind of us versus them thing that we've already got going in our society?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I don't want to overstate the role that schools play in these dynamics, because as you say, a lot of the political polarization that happens in the United States is being driven by a number of other factors, including, as you say, social media, news diets, and, other, longer running social inequalities and issues that that we're trying to deal with politically. But I do think that the schools, as a publicly managed, publicly funded institution, have a very special role in that larger political environment, and that they are a place where, as you suggest, people of differing political stripes, religious backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, different class backgrounds and upbringing come together to understand how to process the political world around them, how to talk about big ideas, and how to disagree about what the future should be. And for that reason, it's really essential that that roof that we put over those discussions be understood to be not tilting one way or the other. So to me, I don't want to, say that, a good balanced institutionally neutral schoolhouse is going to solve all of our political problems for the future. Right. There's nothing like that. But it's one place where we can model how we might do it right.
I think this is something we need to be thinking about. And certainly in education circles, there are discussions about this, and this has implications for politics, culture and society, and our future. And I think what you wrote is really interesting, and we can all check it out on the Washington Post website. I think we've probably heard of that site, washingtonpost.com, but we'll do a direct link up to what you wrote about Chicago Public Schools engaging in what was going on with the protests on May Day in Chicago. Nick Krichka is a historian and an assistant professor of secondary education for social studies at the National College of Education at National Lewis University in Chicago. And he is a CPS parent. Nick, I really enjoyed the conversation today. Thank you so much, and all the best in the future.
Thanks very much, Mike. I'm really, really glad I could come on here and talk to you.
County has more wrongful convictions than any other county in the nation. And just 4 months into 2026, Chicago has already spent $175.6 million on lawsuits against the police. When someone is wrongfully convicted and exonerated, they're still not totally free, as their criminal record for the conviction is still intact. In order to really clear your name, you need what is called a certificate of innocence in Illinois. Dan Hinkle is a senior reporter at Injustice Watch. That's the only newsroom in Cook County dedicated to reporting on the court system. He is authoring a series called Denying Innocence, and his latest piece focuses on how Cook County is trying to limit access to certificates of innocence. We could check out what he's reporting at injusticewatch.org. Dan, welcome back to Outside the Loop. Nice to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
You got it. So, okay, sometimes the legal system gets a little complicated here, and I explained it there. I think I kind of got it right, but basically, we see a lot of wrongful convictions in Cook County, and if you want to clear your name, if you've been convicted of something, it's almost like then at that point, you're guilty until proven innocent, and that's a hard process. Can you explain how that works?
Yeah, well, you did a great job explaining it.
Well, thank you.
The long and short of it is that, when people are exonerated, they generally, they tend to step out of prison with next to no money, very limited job prospects. Many of them have convictions for crimes up to and including murder on the record. Even if, you know, they may have these cases may have been vacated, it's a little much to ask an employer to understand everything about how the legal system works and, you know, might struggle to rent an apartment and all that. So certificates of innocence are designed to help them expunge their records so that they're not visible to people who just, you know, look in the court system. And along with that, there's also sort of relatively modest compensation from the state that works by year in terms of how many years you've been in. It caps out at about, as of now, about $300,000. So for people who did 14 years or more. And, you know, I got to say, as I got to talking to these guys, like there's this sort of practical stuff, but then a lot of them want it for sort of more, I guess, psychic reasons, right? That it's like these folks just want someone to admit that what happened to them was wrong, right? And they want prosecutors to have to come into court and say, yep, they didn't do it.
So, yeah, you know, you're right. And what you report on here in this piece up at injusticewatch.org, I mean, you have some real heart-wrenching stories of how people's lives were really upended by these wrongful convictions. And look, you mentioned it, but if you come out of prison and okay, you've been cleared, you're exonerated, when people do a background check on you, you still might come up as a convicted murderer because that conviction is still there. So that's what we're talking about here. That certificate of innocence really wipes that away. And so what you're talking about here in this reporting, you focus on Eileen O'Neill Burke, who is, I guess she's not the new state's attorney anymore, she's been in the job 17 months, and she's really been kind of at the forefront of challenging a lot of these certificates. Can you explain what's happening here with the state's attorney?
Yeah, absolutely. So under Kim Fox, you know, Kim Fox sort of cut a different profile than a lot of past state's attorneys in Cook County, in that she was, you know, sort of part of her program that was that she was, you know, at least promising to acknowledge the wrongs of the past. And in a lot of cases, you know, prosecutors don't have to object to these. They can be between the exonerated person and the judge. So in, I found is that in Kim Fox's second term, I believe it was, she objected to, I believe, one out of four of these. And whereas Eileen O'Neill Burke has taken a sort of more, I think it would be fair to say more skeptical approach to innocence claims, has objected to four out of five of these so far.
Wow. So let's explore, you know, why this is happening here. Obviously, Kim Fox and Eileen O'Neill Burke, two different people, maybe two kind of views on law enforcement. But as you're saying here, this conviction integrity unit, which was very busy with exonerations under Kim Fox, hasn't cleared anyone since Eileen O'Neill Burke took office. So what's the rationale for what's going on here?
Well, it'd be hard pressed to get me to tell you exactly what the rationale is, I guess the stated rationale anyway. Eileen O'Neill Burke has refused my interview requests for, you know, about a year and a half now. And I should say that her office has said, hey, we're trying to be fair and we're looking at the facts of these cases. Folks who are critical of the office would say, you know, in Cook County, a place where there are something like 500 known wrongful convictions since 1989, that it's sort of mathematically impossible that the prosecutor's office has completely stopped hearing from people whose, you know, claims to innocence might have merit. But I, you know, if Eileen O'Neill Burke happened to hear this, I would absolutely love to sit down and talk with her and get some clear sense of exactly what she's thinking. But at this point, it is quite clear that she is taking the office in a different direction and is just a lot less likely to acknowledge, you know, wrongdoing by her office or police.
And it's that police area aspect that you also report on. You also say essentially that the state's attorney's office is pretty much, you know, defending the work of some of what you call notorious cops. And these are police officers, Chicago police officers with records of abuse, of torture, of extracting false statements from people. And what you're saying here is that in the action or inaction, I suppose, from the state's attorney's office, I mean, that kind of work is not being challenged those stories are not coming back to the forefront here. And look, Chicago has a legacy of this, unfortunately, and a history of doing this. So these cops that, and it's not all cops, obviously, but a few of them, their actions are allowed to stand, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you follow wrongful convictions in Cook County, a pretty persistent story is, you know, one cop who is a sort of commonality across various different claims of, you know, wrongful conviction or wrongdoing. And, you know, for example, an example of an officer who's responsible for some of these cases where Burke has objected to the certificates of innocence is Ronaldo Guevara, who is, you know, obviously one of the most notorious police in recent Chicago history, is sort of famous for being accused of framing defendants on the Northwest Side over the course of a couple of decades. And so the office is now in this position where they are, you know, Tyrese Williams was a gentleman who was featured in my story, and Guevara is the detective in his case. And so, you know, Eileen Burke's office is now going to court and saying, we deny that Guevara abused the witness in Tyrese Williams' case. So, yeah.
It's, again, I just go back to the humanity of this. And you do talk about this gentleman, Tyrese Williams, who was convicted of murder in 1990 in Logan Square. He was exonerated, but now he is in this process of trying to get a certificate of innocence. And what you report, I mean, his kids, you know, they're being brought to him while he's incarcerated. Then after a while, he's like, no, don't bring him anymore, because I'm sick of telling them that, hey, dad's going to get out soon, when I'm not really going to get out soon. His mom died when he was incarcerated. And so, you know, people just miss out on giant parts of their lives. And to what you were saying before, sure, the monetary stuff is good, but it's almost like they just want a psychological, spiritual cleansing here to say, you know what? I want someone to admit that the state got it wrong, that I'm an innocent man, and that I deserve a good life. That's really what it comes down to, I feel like.
I mean, absolutely. And it's an interesting situation where it does feel like there's a couple different conversations going on. Like, a lot of the political subtext of what is happening with certificates of innocence has to do with the fact that exonerated people file them in their federal lawsuits against the city of Chicago, right? As you mentioned earlier on, those have cost the city a gigantic amount of money. There are people who believe that it's the certificates that kind of put the city behind the eight ball and that they are then forced to settle, right? I should say that there, you know, if you talk to lawyers on the other side of this, the plaintiffs bar in these cases, they will say, we actually are not sure that they have that much of an effect, but it has been an operating theory among some in Chicago that a lot of the problem, you know, that the huge cost to taxpayers has been related to the fact that, you know, people come into these cases with certificates of innocence. However, I will say that if you talk to the people who seek them, they will become very emotional, very affected about, they talk a lot about just the things that how they need this for their families, right? How they need them for their kids to understand what happened to them and for their kids to see them officially cleared. I talked to another gentleman who got a certificate of innocence, but ultimately it was bittersweet for him because his mom had died. She didn't get to see him get it. And so, like I say, there's kind of two different conversations happening here. One that revolves around this idea that some people in Chicago have, that it's the certificates of innocence that are causing all this legal liability. And then the other one from the people who are seeking these, that, you know, none of them really talked about the money very much with me at all. And they all just said, I need this for, you know, to feel free.
What you're saying here doesn't look to be like they're just trying to get these certificates of innocence because they want to turn around, sue the city and have a huge payday. It's also a pain in the butt, I should say, to get these certificates of innocence. So it's not like this is a walk in the park. I've spoken to people on this very show who have received certificates of innocence, and it was a long process because, again, that burden of proof shifts to the person who was accused, right? Now you're guilty until you prove yourself innocent.
Yeah.
And right. That's a huge thing to do.
And they're also, for, you know, these people are also being asked to go into exactly the same courtroom where they were convicted of, or sometimes the same courtroom, definitely the same courthouse, where, you know, the worst thing that's ever happened to them in their life happened, right? And so I think that for some of them, when I talked to them, expressed this sense that basically, like, I thought I was out of this, you know, like I thought I was past this. And then it turns out that I have this other fight to have. And it's, you know, for some of these guys, it's pretty triggering, right? To have to contend with the legal system again, and just also be very, very, a lot of them are pretty confused about the prosecutor stepping in, you know, because a lot of these guys view the evidence in their cases as being pretty clear cut. And they say, why fight this? And of course, from the prosecutor side, they make a case. They say, we just don't think you can prove your innocence. So,
well, this is ongoing. Hopefully, through your reporting in this series that you are writing, Dan, called Denying Innocence, maybe you get some on the record comments from the state's attorney's office. Who knows? Maybe she's listening right now.
I would love that. Yeah.
So we should all check out injusticewatch.org. This is really some great reporting. Again, this is part three in a series called Denying Innocence, looking at some of the shortcomings of the court system in Cook County. This specific piece, this latest piece that came out a few days ago, looking at how Cook County is trying to limit access to certificates of innocence. Dan Hinkle is a senior reporter at Injustice Watch. That is the only newsroom in Cook County dedicated to reporting on the court system. Dan, I always appreciate the time and your reporting on this. Thanks so much for chatting today.
I really appreciate you helping me bring attention to it.
And that'll do it. Outside the Loop show number 1021 is done. Thank you very much for listening to the show today. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for all of his engineering skills in the WGN radio studio. Have a wonderful week. I will talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.